Welcome to the Imperial MBA Women's Podcast. My name is Ivy Adedugwe, and this week we'll be discussing women in healthcare technology. I've got a wonderful group of guests today. So I've got Dr. Sairai Ghaffour here with us today. She's the Digital Health Lead at the Institute of Global Health Innovation at Imperial College. She's also a honorary consultant in respiratory medicine at St. Mary's Hospital. She holds an MSc in health policy from Imperial and was also a Harkness Fellow in health policy and practice in New York. She's also the co-founder of two startups, Cyma and Prova Health Limited. With us today, we've also got Professor Ijoma Uchegbu. She's one of the 25 Black female professors in the UK in UK universities. She's a professor of pharmaceutical nanoscience at UCL School of Pharmacy. She's also UCL Vice Provost for Africa and the Middle East. She's the Chief Scientific Officer of Nanomerics, which is a spin-out company from UCL. It's a pharmaceutical nanotechnology company and that specializes in drug delivery solutions for poorly water-soluble drugs. So very welcome, ladies. Thank you for joining us today. So we'll start by asking you to just tell us about your journey into STEM academia. So we'll start with you, Professor Uchegbu.
Oh, thanks very much, Ivy. It's really nice to be here as well. Thanks for having me. So my journey into academia, okay, so I'll start from the very beginning. I fell into it by accident, fell into pharmacy by accident. I was living in Nigeria at the time. So I was born in the UK, but my family went back to Nigeria in the 70s. So I went to university quite young, didn't really know what I wanted to do at all. For me, it was a way to get away from home, to be honest. And I was interested in science, but didn't want to be a doctor because, you know, if you're living in Nigeria and you're interested in science, there's just a one track, you've got to be a doctor. So I didn't want to do that. It was my first bit of rebellion. I was 16 years old at the time. I thought, what else could I do? Pharmacy looked interesting. I had no idea what a pharmacist did. So fell in by accident, finished my degree. And then after sort of working in a pharmacy school, because I decided I didn't want to do patient-facing work, then came to the UK and started a PhD. And when I was doing my PhD, I was actually a single parent because my marriage was over by then. And I had three young children. Youngest was 1.5. The oldest one was 8. Middle one was 4. So I was doing my PhD then. And then I really realized that, oh, I found my niche. I loved doing the experiments. I just loved the creativity associated with plan and experiment and creating new knowledge. It really made me very excited. So and then I finished my PhD. That was 1994 I finished my PhD, and then was looking around for a lectureship. Eventually got one in Scotland. So moved to Strathclyde University, married again and had a fourth child. So I'm a mother, proud mother of four daughters, and I have two grandchildren. So I thought I'd just throw that in there. Yeah. And then started really deciding what I wanted to do. And I wanted to be in drug delivery, but I felt I had to do something different. So I actually started synthesizing my own compounds for drug delivery, trying to make better compounds from the ones we already have. And then, that was my entry. And I thoroughly enjoy my work. I spun out our company about 2010, and it's just now that we're starting to do licensing deals in the last 3-4 years. So it's a very long, slow journey, you know. I just hope that I begin to reap the rewards before I shuffle off this earth, you know. So yeah, that's me in a nutshell.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. And Dr. Ghaffour, would you mind telling us about your journey through academia?
Absolutely. And that was such a wonderful journey listening to you and how you said you kind of fell into accidentally. And I think I would definitely say I fell into accidentally. So I wouldn't class myself as an academic. I was employed as a senior policy fellow at the Institute of Global Health Innovation. So I, like many Asian females from my background, was, you know, encouraged by my parents at a very young age to go and be a doctor because, you know, that's what is one of the acceptable career choices. So started, you know, medical school, specialised in respiratory medicine, did my training, and then throughout my higher training, basically decided, you know, always had a very strong interest in policy and politics. and did a series of fellowships, and one was up in Sheffield, where I was training at the time, and then one was in London at NHS England, and that was really to get to know the health sector a lot better in terms of a kind of policy perspective. And then at the end of my respiratory training, I went to the States and did a Harkness Fellowship. And that for me, I think, was really quite a pivotal year in terms of kind of really having the headspace to explore my interests and kind of, get into the whole digital side of things with, the opportunity to really kind of push the boundaries as to what I was interested in. When I moved back from New York, the opportunity at Imperial came up, and that was to lead the digital health team. And that was very much an open book, and it was kind of, you want a new digital health strategy for the Institute. Here you go, do what you want with it. So it was quite daunting, because as a respiratory physician, or kind of as a doctor, you kind of go in, you do your job, you know what you're expecting, and then to all of a sudden have this like blank slate, and then to be, having to produce something that was compelling, I had to get funding, and certainly have all the kind of academic outputs that are necessary for somewhere. It's quite a daunting task, but has been an incredible journey over the past 3 years. And we set up new endeavours such as cybersecurity and healthcare, and we claim to be the first academic centre to do that. But certainly just meeting so many interesting people along the way, the opportunity to do so many different things, and I think working with other academics, working with people from industry, policymakers, governments, both nationally and internationally, I think has been incredible. Prior to moving to the States, I had the idea of setting up one of the first startups, and that was SIMA, which is online mental health therapy. And that has grown over the past couple of years, and we're going for our first funding round. And then the other company, Prova Health, has very much been as a kind of springboard from some of the work that we did at Imperial as well. So all in all, it's been a super interesting journey and met some brilliant people along the way.
Yeah, it sounds like you've definitely jam-packed quite a lot into your career so far. I can certainly testify as a doctor as well, it's quite hard to balance clinical work with your sort of academic endeavours as well. So I'm going to ask you a question. What strategies have you employed to remain competitive and innovative in the space that you're working with? So I'll come to you first, Professor Ochukwu.
I think for us, one of the key things was that we were making our own compounds. And so if you're designing your own compounds from scratch and synthesizing them, already you've got an edge. And we made them, sort of thinking, well, there are lots of deficiencies when it comes to developing medicines, especially medicines that have poor water solubility or medicines that are particularly labile. They disintegrate quite easily and degrade quite easily in the body. So that was our focus. And then actually, once we had made these new compounds, we started discovering lots and lots of interesting things about them. And these interesting things are things that we've been able to then use and enable particular medicines. So one of the medicines we've made is our pain medicine, which is based on enkephalin. We all have enkephalin in our brains, and it's a very good painkiller, but it's difficult to make into a medicine because you have to get it into the brain, and you have to get it into the brain intact so that it can work. And so you've all probably heard about the opioid crisis and how terrible that is. So many people, morphine is a fantastic drug, but it has a lot of baggage. It kills about 15,000 people every year in the States. These opioids, that's OxyContin, fentanyl, morphine, and these are prescription drugs. So we really need to develop new painkillers. So we looked at enkephalin and sort of made that then into a drug, licensed it out, and it's now being developed by the NIH. It's being developed by the NIH because of societal need. And the company that we licensed it to has a very good multi-million dollar collaboration with the NIH for this medicine. So we remain competitive by having our own unique molecules and working in our own unique space. So when I first came into this, people would take things off the shelf and try and combine them in different quantities in order to have something different. But we started from scratch, made new molecules. Of course, that's difficult because you then have to do all the toxicology studies. I got a big Wellcome Trust grant to do that. So, it's very exciting when you have a great idea. It's even more exciting when you have the idea funded. And it's very, very exciting when the idea actually delivers
Yeah.
So sometimes you get a great idea, you don't get it funded. And if you get it funded and you do all the tests, actually, it's a complete pile of so it doesn't go anywhere. So it's really nice when everything lines up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that you just beautifully illustrated what my next question was going to be, which was, you know, how do you turn translational research into a business? You know, we've just heard the recent announcement of the COVID vaccine being available, hopefully in the nearest future. And that's come out of the research from, you know, a couple in Germany who've worked on mRNA for many years. Can you talk us through that entrepreneurial journey? You know, how you go from being a scientist in the lab creating this amazing thing that, you know, only scientists understand, to then being in the business arena and translating that into something that's actually useful for people?
Well, it's very, very difficult, I would say that. So I sound all bright and bubbly, but I'm really just trying to conceal the pain associated with that. As a scientist, you communicate in a particular way, you do experiments, and it's on the one hand or on the other hand. But if you're trying to push a product, you have to harness all the good points about that product, and then you have to solve all the problems associated with that product before you get someone to accept it. So one of the hardest things I had when I first started is you go in there and you think, I've created this great technology, and you finish talking and nobody gets it. And my first thought is, it's got nothing to do with me. I'm doing a great job communicating. It's all down to you. After a few painful episodes, I had to acknowledge that actually, you're a rubbish communicator. You have to start communicating simply, and you have to capture people's imagination. So that was quite a journey for me, for sitting in a meeting and talking about things and getting all these questions and feeling more and more irritated. But now I understand that when I get questions, it's because people are interested in what I'm saying. And also, when they ask me questions that show they haven't understood it, it's I'm at fault. I'm the one with the deficit who hasn't been able to communicate. So that was a big journey. Communication is half of it, but finding a match for your technology and a real world problem, that is very difficult. Because the moment you start saying you can solve a real world problem, you have to look at all the 1,000 other solutions and discount them one by one. So we found that very difficult. It took us years to decide where we were going to put the technology. We went down a number of rabbit holes, a number of cul-de-sacs until we found this space. So we're interested in delivering to the brain and in ocular delivery. But it's long winding, very, very painful. Every single one of my grey hairs comes from trying and failing.
Thank you so much for that. I'll come to you, Dr. Gafoor. So, you know, as Professor Uchebwe has said, you know, being a scientist or coming from a science background and learning to pitch in the business world, how did you find that? Did you bootstrap your businesses, or did you have to pitch to get funding to help get it off ground?
Yeah, absolutely. I think communication is so key, isn't it, with any of, you know, when you're communicating any idea and putting it forward. With Saima, we bootstrapped it, or we have bootstrapped it today, and we're now going out for our first funding round. But along the way, we've had to, you know, pitch the idea to, you know, whether it's angels who are interested, or whether it's to potential clients, so all of that. And, you know, it takes time to absolutely perfect your pitch, because, you know, what you think, or you've been doing for the past, you know, couple of years, and you're, you know, you're so deep in it that you don't kind of understand the wood from the trees, really, and other people are kind of looking at you like, I have no idea what you're saying. So absolutely, it's perfecting that elevator pitch. And, you know, you practice. And actually, one of the big lessons was when I moved to the US, the different styles in communication. So from the UK, and especially being Scottish, we're very, very self-deprecating. And you kind of think, you know, kind of got this good idea, you might like it. And actually spending some time there, and how they're so much more confident, and the way that they present themselves, and much more eloquent in that pitch. And it's that self-belief, and it's building that up and actually really believing what you're doing is going to work, is going to develop into something, and it's kind of bringing that forward, and for that, you know, the person that you're pitching to or the person you're speaking to, for them to believe it as well. And I think absolutely holding that is quite difficult, and it's you know, believing in that, practicing your pitch nonstop, and like Professor Chekwu was saying, is, you know, absolutely making sure your communication is on point. And if it's not, then going back to think, what have you done that's not right, and re-practicing it again.
What are the economic challenges you found with launching your technology company?
I mean, the big one is we've had to bootstrap to date, and we were lucky enough that we were able to do that. I think in the past couple of years, the market's not been quite ready, or certainly in the UK, for online therapy, and really to kind of push that and making sure that we were still able to kind of survive without having the revenue that now we're kind of beginning to see. And certainly COVID has completely accelerated all of the online consultations, whether it's for mental health or whether it's physical health, but we've seen a huge increase in the number of clients that are coming through. So certainly I think those challenges as well, right at the beginning, how are you actually going to pay for everything, the development, what happens if something goes wrong, how will you kind of, what's your kind of backup in case of that? And actually when you're putting your life's worth of investment into it, then actually, you know, you're kind of quite close to the bone sometimes. And then going out for investment as well. So all of this work that we have been doing has been above and beyond our kind of day jobs. My co-founder is my sister. She's a clinical psychologist and a subject matter expert and is able to integrate some of her work. But, you know, essentially you're giving up a big part of your life. You are giving up, you know, money that you would be spending otherwise. And then looking for funding, the next step is certainly, you know, you have the responsibility with other people's money. And you're clearly going to be accountable for that. And again, I think going from the experience of being a doctor and not having any experience in any of this in terms of, you know, financial management, etc., to then all of a sudden you're responsible for a company, one the mental health one the other one, with very little expertise, you rapidly have to learn in the job.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you on so many points there. I think learning on the go is often something that, you know, most entrepreneurs say that they've had to do, and actually the reality is usually much, much more than what you learn from the books, like we are currently doing on the MBA course. So I'm going to ask you, what would you say has been the greatest hurdles that you've encountered during your entrepreneurial journey? I'll come to you, Professor Chagri.
I think I would say it probably boils down to funding. That was, I think that was very, very difficult in the beginning when we had no funding, and we put £5,000 of our savings into the business. And, you know, developing medicines is a $1 billion business. So you can imagine that £5,000 was a drop in the ocean. And then we got what could be considered to be seed funding from the Innovate, used to be called TSB in those days. And we got a £1.3 million grant from them, which we had to match fund. And that's why I say the biggest hurdle is money. So we got this £1.3 million, and we had a company who said, oh, they would work with us on this enkephalin product. And they would then offer us the match funding, which was about £400,000. And so we got the grant, and hip, hip, hooray. And remember, we've got £5,000 that we've put in it and spent. And then the company walked away. Oh, wow. And when they walked away, well, if you don't have much funding, you can't have that £1.3 million. And literally, you don't sleep. This was your big opportunity, and it looks as if it's going to disappear. But then we got this larger contract from another company who wanted us to do some work for them based on our technology. And that was how we were able to then get our match funding for this grant. And that was the start of this pain product, which we've now out-licensed. So money is very, very difficult. We fund our company with a lot of the people that want to license, and they give us feasibility studies. And that's how we've been going all the time. We now have you know, we're moving into probably doing a Series A, but, you know, we're not sure that we're going to do it because we've got some licenses that are going to pay out soon. But money in those early days, it's very, very hard to get the money, especially with a drug delivery business where you don't have new chemical entities that you're developing as drugs. So that I think is a very large hurdle, actually. And we've only just been able to get past it, you know, these past, I would say, 4 or 5 years. So that as it's a hard business, but you're driven, literally, you're driven because it's not so much the financial reward, but actually academics that go into spin outs, and Sarah, you can correct me if I'm wrong, you're driven because you want to see what you've created have real world impact. Of course, you want to get paid, but the thing that gets you up every day and gets you scrabbling around in the dirt for pennies is the fact that, oh my God, I remember drawing this molecule on a piece of paper, and now it's going to be dosed to patients. That's what keeps you going. So when it all looks bleak, remember that you're creating something that did not exist. And I think that alone is enough. I died on that for weeks, and then I have my downtime when something goes wrong. But then I remember that actually this did not exist. And it's very powerful.
Yeah.
It is ultimately vanity, I might add. But it's very powerful.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's truly amazing. And I think that is, you know, that truly illustrates the heart of most scientists to actually see your work benefit the world out there. So I'm going to come to you as well, Dr. Kafoor, if you could tell us what are the biggest hurdles that you've had in your journey being an entrepreneur?
So I'd certainly speak about SIMA, the mental health app. So initially, you know, we had this great idea. It was all on paper. We'd got the tech developed. It looked really cool. It was really, you know, we had all these big ideas, and yeah, we're going to launch it on the App Store and we're going to have loads of customers come through. So we hadn't really thought much about the whole kind of marketing aspect. And our kind of first business strategy was B2C. And essentially, after a very small trickle of people downloading the app, and that was mainly friends and family, over the next couple of months, then we're kind of thinking, okay, what do we do in terms of marketing? And then, you know, that strategy didn't really pay off. And then it was quite disheartening when you know, clearly now in hindsight, we're very naive at the start as to, you know, thinking that one thing that we think that is great and would work really well, and we think the clinical impact of it would be great, is actually not materialized into what we thought it'd be. And then we rapidly had to change strategy, that actually that's not going to work. The market, the online market, is very nascent in the UK. I don't think the public were quite ready for online therapy. And so our kind of strategy changed to B2B, and actually it was, you know, how can this fit into an employee benefit package? And kind of quickly changing it around, who then do we target? Who's our kind of like consumer market? And actually the biggest payer for the mental health market is the NHS. And actually both of us work in the NHS, and so it's appropriate to get into the NHS. But then that's a whole other story to break into the NHS. Like, you might as well, you'd be like better off robbing a bank, really. So I think, you know, that took time, patience, effort, repeated conversations, repeated meetings, presentations, etc. And we have been successful in the end of, you know, procuring NHS work. But certainly I think it's the kind of the frustration, but also you kind of get disheartened after, you know, you think that this is great, this works, we can show proof of concept. But certainly I think it's, you know, re-strategizing, thinking again, how can we make it better? How can we change? And at the end of the day, you have something that can make people's lives better, as Professor Chegwu was saying. And, you know, at the end of the day, we measure, you know, all the data that we're collecting in terms of improved outcomes for patients. You see that, and you see that it's working well. And you see that people are having a good experience using it, and you think, actually, yes, this works. And then more people.
Yeah, no, that's truly amazing. So then that brings me up to the next question, which is, where do you see the role of technology helping to reduce the sort of gender gap we have in society, because it's often said that, you know, women struggle to raise funds, you know, when it comes to raising funds for a company, in the technology space, in any STEM area, even though there are more and more women studying these subjects, it's quite hard, you know, it's not the same level playing field with men in the same field. So do you see a role for technology leveling the gender gap?
Is that true?
Yeah, you could go first.
No, I mean, maybe Sarah should go first because more a technology company.
So in terms of technology being the game changer, I think, you know, certainly in the digital health world, you go to conferences, you know, certainly meetings at the college, meetings with other people, it is very male dominated still. And, you know, we keep talking about how the needle's moved on or whatever else. But still, you know, we are so far behind, and things have to change. STEM, various initiatives like Athena Swan and whatever else that universities are employing, I think definitely have made great strides. But, you know, it's not okay anymore. It's, you know, we've got women who are underrepresented, women of colour who are underrepresented, and actually we're missing out huge swathes of society. It's not, you know, things like the concept of femtech. Why is it even called femtech when actually it represents so frustrating? And the fact that actually women, in terms of healthcare dollars spent, 90% of healthcare dollars are spent by women, and now we have this concept of femtech is, you know, a complete misnomer. And, you know, is the fact that I think one of the Rock Health reported that last year only 7% of VC funding in the US went to female-led startups, and this year it's been even less, it's down to 3%. And that's, I mean, who is getting the rest of the money? And actually that's 93% of funding is going to male-led startups that actually then potentially don't have the ideas that are going to be appealing to 50% of society. I think it's insane. So I think it really, for the people who are out there, we need to support each other. We need to make sure there's a network. There are some great initiatives out there, and actually call out bad behavior, call out the fact that, you know, if you're the manuals that we speak on, or, you know, the fact that you're the only woman in the room, is not okay in this day and age. In 2020, we need to do better. And I think we are part of the problem sometimes for not calling it out. And now I think it's our duty to call it out. And I think certainly, you know, I'll stop my rant there.
No. I mean, the statistic you quoted there is truly shocking, actually.
There's so much more.
Yeah, because especially as most medical schools now have over 50% female candidates, you would expect a lot more in that field.
Contribute to that.
Please do.
Have a slightly different bent, and to say, you know, we all know when we're thinking about solving a problem, there's lots of data that says that if you have a diverse team solving a problem, you actually get better outputs. And there's lots of data around that from Kinsey study, looking at the way jurors make their decisions, or the way stocks are priced. But nevertheless, you have a very narrow field of people actually doing research. Very narrow, homogeneous. So the typical researcher, despite the fact that women are going to medical school and pharmacy is a very female also profession, the typical researcher is a white male. And the typical research teams are white males. And if you want to go onto any company that's making medicines and look at their board, it's as if you step back to 1950. Yeah, the whole board will be white male. Now, I think that the COVID crisis really demonstrates why we need diverse teams controlling the research narrative. And I make this point again and again and again. When you look at the communities that have been disproportionately affected, Black communities, Pakistani communities, Bangladeshi communities, poor people, people with less resources, and certain occupations, you wonder, why did we not see this coming? Why we didn't see it coming is that a very narrow section of society controls the research narrative. they don't want to look at the effect of infectious diseases on different races or on different socioeconomic groups. So now we have this, we've got fantastic universities, the best universities in the world in the UK. And we have, all, I think we're third when it comes to per capita deaths from COVID. Now we're having a second lockdown, which doesn't just affect those communities, it affects us all. We're going to have a recession that's going to affect everyone. Now, if we had a diverse group controlling the research narrative, people would study different things. And this wouldn't have been a surprise. That people are dying in droves, linked to poverty, linked to race, linked to occupations. So if this doesn't make us change the way we do things, then nothing will.
No, I completely agree with you. And that just naturally slides into the next question, which I was going to bring to you, Dr. Gafoor, which is with regards to data that's being used for developing healthcare technology. If I was to start a new, you know, I wanted to start a new technology company, what would you advise me to do in terms of making sure that the data I'm using to validate whatever technology I'm putting out there truly is representative of society?
Absolutely. And this is one of the pieces of work that we're doing at the moment, is looking at AI and machine learning and the opportunities and challenges offered to Black minority ethnic communities. And I think data is such a huge opportunity, but also how we use it is, you know, is fraught with potential challenges. So it's the data that you collect, you've got to make sure it's a representative sample of the population that you're then going to test any kind of algorithm on, again, needs to be representative. But then also taking on from Professor Chegbu's point as well, is that diverse group of people who are also overseeing what you're actually doing with it, in terms of, you know, sometimes I don't think people are in any way willing to, you know, be difficult or anything, but I think it's making sure that you've got, if they are not aware of that problem, then they can't see the problem coming up. So it's kind of having that diversity in the group to bring up problems that may manifest down the line. So I think it's that, you know, having all those different data points, but it's, and actually, what is the question at the end of the day that you're trying to solve with the data? And is it going to disproportionately affect one portion of society? And then, you know, that changes the way that you collect data, or how will you test it in another way? So I think it's such a huge opportunity out there. But again, like I said, fraught with challenges. But certainly, I think from a data collection perspective, you know, you need to have data there to prove that anything that you're working on does work. It shows good outcomes. And certainly as a purchaser of any technology, you want to see that data up front. Before you kind of make any kind of decision into purchasing it.
Yeah, and I completely agree with you. I think since COVID, we've seen such a rapid adoption of technology into the NHS. And I think some of the concerns about the rapid way that things have been adopted in, people are worried about data and privacy issues, and validity of all the technology being adopted in.
There's two elements to it. So one's the kind of actually the validation of anything. And I think this is where, again, we are very early on. And the other startup that we're working with, Pova Health, that very much looks at how do you generate evidence in a pragmatic way, especially for digital health technologies, because we know that we can't really, you know, go back to doing RCTs. We don't have 3 years in which to complete something. We don't have the funding to do it. And certainly, especially when you're working with smaller startups as well, you need to be able to generate evidence. You need to be able to generate this pragmatically and thinking, what are the clinical outcomes that you're trying to affect? What would a kind of purchaser want to see? How can you do that without actually employing a massive whole-scale study, which you can't have access to patients, you don't have access to clinical areas, and it's that kind of chicken and egg situation for someone to say, oh, can you provide us evidence? Oh, but we don't have patients, or we don't have the clinical situation in which that we can do it. And you kind of go round and round in circles. So it's kind of thinking of different ways, such as simulation as an example, to see can you use that as a tool to generate evidence. So that's one side of things, but then it's also the kind of data privacy, security and trust element that you need to make sure right from, you know, that is a priority right from the start, because once you lose that, you've kind of lost, essentially you've lost that goodwill, you've lost your currency that you have with that, you know, population that you're wanting to target. And certainly, you know, in this day and age, making sure you're adhering to GDPR, any kind of data privacy, data governance, and certainly the security side of things as well, need to make sure that's, you know, front and foremost. And unfortunately, in terms of the market in the UK and more globally as well, I don't think we have done enough, certainly from the security side of things either.
And I completely agree with you, but it sounds like NHSX is on the ball with trying to get us up to speed legally with all of that stuff in the NHS.
Very lucky to have different bodies working with us as well.
Yeah, no, that's true. So this question is for you, Professor Uchegru. How did you go about getting intellectual property for your company's technology?
Oh, it's not complex at all. You literally write a patent application. And once you've written a patent application, then you go toe-to-toe with the examiner. The examiner always comes back and said, it's not novel, it's not inventive. And so you just have to go back and say, yes, it is. And here's the reason why. We've got many patents. I'm the lead inventor on all the patents in Nanomerics at the moment. And, you know, I think we've got about 8 patent families. I think yesterday I was, you know, preparing a response to the examiner. This is our third time going round and round in circles, you know. So sometimes actually we've phoned the examiner and said, what would you accept? And try to argue the case. You know, you do it mostly in writing. Each time you do it, it's ka-ching, £5,000 each response. But the moment, if I was advising someone who was thinking of starting a company, you get your technology or whatever it is that you're going to use to underpin the company. Immediately you get that, you write your patent application, then you can publish. But you also have to have some trade secrets, which you won't tell anyone about, you know, unless they are they've got a license to your technology. So the intellectual property protection is fairly straightforward. Apply for the patent, defend the patent, get the patent granted. So a lot of our key patents are already granted in multiple territories. And then you also have to pay to keep them going for the next, till they expire 20 years after you filed. So it's very expensive. It's a big part of our expenditure in our company is maintaining the patent estate.
Yeah, I can imagine that. But I guess from the sort of business, with a business hat on, the patents will, you know, you can certainly look at them as assets that you could possibly sell on to other companies for the future whilst you still have the patent lease. So then I'll come to our
we license.
Okay, fine. So then I'm going to come to our last question just to wrap up our discussions. How do you manage the sort of loneliness of being at the top and being a female leader in, you know, the space that you're working in? Because as we've said through this conversation, you know, there are not many women in running female tech companies around the world. Like, how do you manage that? Do you have a group of people that you go to when you have decision-making processes to make?
Well, in our company, we've got a board and we've got 4 people. I'm the only woman. But to be honest, that our board is fantastic. We handpicked our board. We handpicked our scientific advisory board as well as our governing board. And they're so supportive. And the fact that they are men doesn't make them less supportive. And, you know, you kind of, you know, we own most of the company, but you kind of forget that, you do forget that there is the gender imbalance, I think, when I'm dealing with them. But it would be lovely if we could have a network of women entrepreneurs, because the female journey is different. Most definitely it is different. When you walk into a space and you're pitching as a woman, the response is different from if you're pitching as a man. So it'd be nice to have a network of people who are entrepreneurs and female. I remember when I was doing some work, I won't mention the agency, but a large government agency that was giving out funding to companies. And most of the pitches were done by men, and a pitch that was led by a woman, And I had to fight quite hard for her to get funded, because there were some people who the shutters just went down. She was a youngish woman in her 30s. She had a great idea. She pitched really well. And nevertheless, I felt that the hostility that she generated, I could see no other reason than because of her gender. And I had to fight quite hard for her to really get funding in the end and get, you know, get a good score, because I felt that she had a really good idea. And I felt that the negative comments lacked merit. Justify what you're saying. And then you get wishy-washy things. Oh, I just don't think it's good enough. I don't think they have it. You know, just things that are without evidence.
Yeah. And Dr. Gafford, you get the final word on that question.
I've been very lucky. My co-founder for SIMA is my sister, and also obviously female. And we work very well together. We have a senior advisor who's actually male, who's absolutely brilliant and, you know, great sounding board for us. For the other startup, is myself and the other men. And I think we've had a great working relationship. And certainly, I think that's been good. But I think there's lots of new initiatives being set up. There's the Women of Wearables group, and they certainly link lots of women founders or people interested in the kind of tech space with either funders or kind of, you know, having the connecting them to other entrepreneurs as well, to see if there's any scope for kind of advisory capacity there, or any networking as well. So I think initiatives like that are great, and certainly I think more than anything I always like feel that it's my duty to kind of give back as well in terms of a mentoring support for others kind of entering into this space as well. So I've been super lucky throughout my career to have brilliant mentors, both male and female, who really helped me along the way, and always like believe that, you know, pay it forward to others as well.
I know, so thank you very much for that. It's been an absolutely wonderful conversation. I have certainly learned a lot from both of you, and I hope our listeners will learn a lot as well when they listen. So thank you very much for coming on. Thank you.